To God's hands I place my heart. I am not afraid. Adonai, I lift my eyes when all is night. When I need help, I seek God's light. Afraid, Adonai Eli. I am not afraid, Adonai Eli. Welcome. I wish we were meeting under a happier situation. My name is Doug Kotler. I'm a cantor in Southern California. And as I officiate quite often at funerals and memorial services, so often I'm standing up here and say, sadly, I did not know the deceased in life. As I've met with the family just a day or two before and taken notes and prepared eulogy and facilitated the family in saying goodbye to their loved one. Sadly, this is not the case, for I am one of Millie's nephews, and have known her, or she has known me, she knew me for my entire life. So I join you as one of the community of the mourners in this particular situation. There's a beautiful Hebrew prayer, a blessing that is recited each Sabbath, each Shabbat. It's recited by the husband to his wife. And it says, Eshet Chayil Mi Yimtza, a woman of valor, a woman of courage, who can find a woman, a remarkable woman. And indeed, Millie was quite remarkable. The prayer goes on to say, her price is far beyond rubies, and indeed the facets of Millie's remarkable life are in the way that each of these facets reflected light to each of us and made our life, each of our lives, so much more profound and meaningful. We're going to hear this afternoon from several relatives, and I think it will be illuminating for each. Each of us had our own relationship with Millie and with the family. Each of us saw her and related to her in a slightly different way. Each one very meaningful and each one very loving. To start, I'd like to call up my brother Steve, one of Millie's nephews.
To three little boys growing up in California, Aunt Millie and Levittown were always part of our family. In the late 40s and early 50s, when long-distance telephone calls were an expensive luxury, the importance, the constancy of close, warm relationships between my mother, the warm relationship between my mother and her sister, was reinforced by stories, by snapshots, and the occasional cross-country train ride. Stories of family, always stories of family. Anecdotes told with warmth and humor about interesting, important people. Important because they were family. Important because they had character, or they were characters. Important because they were originally from Brooklyn, home of my beloved Dodgers. Because of that close sisterly connection, Aunt Millie was the most important of those people. My older brother Lanny remembers at age 5 being at Millie and Herb's wedding. He even remembers the color of Millie's dress. I don't. I do, however, remember precisely where I was when my mother told me of Millie's first stillborn child. That was my first impression of death. Millie was ever present in our home because I was convinced that my Aunt Millie was the woman on the Sun-Made box holding all those raisins. She sat prominently on our little boy's breakfast table. Because Millie and Edie's mother, my grandmother, known in the early days of air travel as Transcontinental Tessie, alternated living on two coasts and two homes, Herb and Millie's growing family was described with affection and lots of superlatives. As I got older, I began to see differences between our two households. In Levittown, Millie and Herb's morning tableau included ritual readings from the New York Times. In Oxnard, the local paper, the Press Courier, was an excellent beginning to any papier-mâché project. The humor in my home was extended storytelling with Yiddish accents and borscht belt punchlines. In Levittown, it was Uncle Herb's sly one-liners and unexpected winks. My house was seemingly ever on the edge of what we called adventure, but was probably chaos. And there was a lot less yelling in Levittown. It was a very warm and comfortable place for us. I saw Aunt Millie as an organized, efficient person, completely in control. She had unbelievable retrieval capabilities of an impressive inventory. If a hard line drive just ripped through the webbing of your favorite glove and you needed a piece of rawhide cord for repair, Aunt Millie would ask, how thick and what color? And then she'd go right to the box in the garage that had it. Imagine how much better Washington would have functioned with Milley as a cabinet secretary. Defense, agriculture, maybe not, but education, health and human services, a better place entirely. Some family lessons are easier to learn when they come from outside your own home, when they're taught by aunts and uncles. By watching how Milley loved and honored her mother, I learned how to love and honor mine. By watching how she loved and honored her children, I learned how to love and honor mine. From Aunt Milley, I got advice, lots of advice. I didn't always ask for it. I didn't always take it. But I was always aware that it was probably right. Sprucewood Drive was always open to me. When I was sent home with mononucleosis from a camp counselor's job in Maine in the summer after my freshman year, Milley took me in and nursed me. After my divorce, when I would come east to be with my young daughters who were living in Connecticut, Milley was an additional, unconditionally loving grandmother to them. And her home with its big dress-up box of clothes was where they frolicked and where I healed. She held me in my arms, in her arms, when I was little, and held me in her heart every day she was alive. Without question, she was my favorite aunt. And I will hold her in my heart forever.
We'll hear next from Steve's daughter, great-niece, Julie.
The summer I was 7 years old, as my father mentioned, we went and lived with Aunt Milley and Uncle Herb. My parents had been divorced for about a year, and that house on Sprucewood was just a haven of stability and calm. And it was a wonderful place to be. And because I was so small at the time, my memories are kind of flashes and fleeting things. So instead of trying to put them all together, I just wanted to share with you a few of them. Foremost in my memory was that wall where she kept track of how tall everybody was. And I knew that she'd sort of moved on to a new place in her life, and because we'd sort of been her grandkids until she actually had grandkids. When I came back as an adult and I realized that her grandkids had been marked on the wall so many times that we'd been smudged away. I couldn't find us there anymore. I remember we were there for the 4th of July, and I still can't believe she let us set off firecrackers in the street. But we did. With the neighborhood kids, and there was the dress-up box and the giant loom that took up an entire room, shared the room with an upright piano. I played with my dad. We only had one song. We never managed to get beyond that, but nobody seemed to complain. I believe I may be the last person of my generation who actually knows what a party line was on the telephone, because Millie and Herb had it. My husband still can't believe that I've ever experienced a party line. It was a wonderful place, and if there's one great regret of my adulthood is that I was not able to keep in closer touch with Aunt Milley and Uncle Herb. But one of my final memories, although it was a while ago, but that I will treasure, I came back for Uncle Herb's funeral as well, and I had a 5-month-old daughter, so I couldn't leave her home, so I had her with me. And I took her to meet her great-great-aunt Milley. And Maddie told me later that it was the first time Milley had smiled since Uncle Herb had passed away. And I will not forget that smile that day when she saw the first member of the next generation. And on that note, I'd like to read a little bit, both my sisters, just to give you an idea how special Milley was to us. My two sisters who were with me that summer were absolutely insistent that I read something from each of them, to the point where I was getting menacing phone calls. You know, have you downloaded your email? Have you printed your email? Will you read it? Yes, yes. So I'm going to start with my younger sister, Abby. Sister, I have a few random memories of my early childhood, but one that sticks out is visiting Aunt Millie and Uncle Herb on Long Island, playing hide-and-seek with my sisters in their house, following Cousin Phil's dog, Betty, around everywhere. Poor Phil, everybody always asked about Betty first. Says, that house is where I was taught not to bug a dog while she's eating. Getting enveloping hugs from Millie while Herb sat quietly, observing the Cotler chaos. Aunt Millie's hugs always felt safe and strong, and they made me feel special. When she gave me her attention, she gave it to me in full, and she was always interested. The last hug we shared a little while ago at Uncle Jack's house was just as safe, just as strong, and just as special. Maybe even more so, because my son Ethan got to join in and feel an Aunt Millie hug, and she was interested. And from my older sister, Emily. She titled this Rhiannon's Great-Great-Aunt Millie, and Rhiannon is my sister's two-year-old. My grandmother's sister died this morning. My Aunt Millie was a lot of things, but closest to my heart was her overflowing adoration of Rhiannon. Millie was enamored of her. I regularly sent Millie photos, usually accompanied by some of Rhiannon's crayon scribbles. Aunt Millie always sent a handwritten thank you note back saying how beautiful and charming she felt my child was. From the time she was 5 weeks old, Rhiannon parked herself in Millie's heart, and Millie called her Rhiannon to me and to Brian, but when she held an infant Rhiannon 2 years ago, she cooed Rhianny. The name didn't stick, but the memory has. This last fall, we went to see Millie several times when she was visiting my great-uncle Jack. Having grown into a toddler, Rhiannon now exhausted Millie and, of course, wouldn't sit still to be cooed at. But Rhiannon had pretty much just learned to say her own name when asked, and she and Aunt Millie sat together for a few minutes and said each other's names in their own. It wasn't really a conversation, but it was. Thank you.
And we'll hear now from another nephew, Bill Fenston.
Wonderful to speak today here. I know there's so many Millie Cantor groupies that I brought my own binoculars. Okay. I didn't prepare an elaborate speech. I'm sure she'd fuss at me. She always said, be prepared, Billy. I was always Billy. If I'm 118, I'll look around the corner, hear the name Billy, I'll look for my Aunt Millie and Uncle Herb. But the most wonderful memory I have of her is one day in Halloween. I was in Levittown for some reason. We must have had cataclysmic weather problems in Buffalo. I couldn't imagine why I was in Levittown on Halloween, but I remember exquisitely that Phil was the baker, and they were all at school, and I was like, how would we say, the guinea pig. She put the baker's outfit on me. She put the apron. She even threw flour on me. She measured, she sewed. I swear she spent a whole day on that Halloween costume. And after Phil came home, typical 11-year-old, he just cavalierly assumed, I'm ready for Halloween. And he went out, and he was not my cherished cousin Phil Cantor anymore. He was Phil Cantor, pastry chef, 11-year-old pastry chef in Levittown, Long Island. I think the greatest qualities of Millie were that she gave you a sense of significance, that you were important to her, that you mattered. She was one of the few relatives that ever visited me in Buffalo. And one day we were traveling, she and Herb came through Elder Hostel in the 80s, and we were traveling through City Hall, around City Hall, and she says, what is that, Bill? I said, that's Buffalo City Hall. I know it's sort of tiny. So that's Buffalo's answer to Red Square. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. We're going to hear now from Millie's children. We'll start with Carrie, married to Phil.
Like all of us here, I grew up hearing jokes about mothers-in-law. The mother-in-law, especially the Jewish kind, is supposed to make life miserable for whoever marries her precious son. Well, when I got married and acquired a Jewish mother-in-law of my own, it was my great fortune for it to be Millie. I do have to say that in one of my very first experiences with her, I got a taste of her often but not always endearing tell-it-like-it-is style. At the time, I was an editor for a newsletter that covered the international oil industry. She quizzed me for several moments to find out exactly what I did there. And after she'd heard what she needed to hear in order to come to a conclusion about the whole thing, she opined, "That must be dull as dishwater." But it was all roses after that. P.S., I left that job a year later, changed careers, and yes, it was dull as dishwater. She was a dream mother-in-law, always helpful, nurturing, respectful, and most of all, loving. She knew she had raised sensible children and that those sensible children had the good judgment to pick sensible spouses. She showed all of us nothing but support, trust, and love. While I, of course, have many, many memories of Millie accumulated over the years, some stand out. One in particular was when I was in my first trimester pregnant with Ethan. I felt nauseated all the time, and food preparation was a challenge, yet I so needed to eat to settle my stomach. Food preparation was not Phil's forte at that time. One day Millie came over and made me a nice, bland, delicious, nutritious chicken sandwich that I will remember forever. I remember feeling so well taken care of and so glad that she was there. I also remember how wonderful she was with my boys, especially when they were little, and at that stage in which the details of life that adults take for granted are so fascinating, Millie seemed to really get that fascination and knew just how to feed it. She would let them mix things, wash things in her sink, take apart things, pour things into other things. She would cook with them, sew with them, knit with them. It was called Camp Grandma, and it was delightful for them and for her. Millie was a force and a personality to be reckoned with. She was the most organized person I've ever known. She didn't suffer fools gladly, and she often said she enjoyed her own company. She was a woman who knew what she liked and what she wanted. Restaurant owners quaked in their boots when they saw her coming. She was competent and knowledgeable about all kinds of things. I anticipate that as life unfolds from here forth, many Let's Ask Millie moments will arise that will make us feel her loss all over again, such as when we want to know how to get a stain out of something, or especially if we wonder if some famous person might be half Jewish. I recently came across this quote from Winston Churchill, and it made me think of Millie. Quote, "I am ready to meet my maker. Whether my maker is prepared for the great ordeal of meeting me is another matter." I imagine her somewhere in heaven right now telling the celestial chef that the food is just a little too salty or needs extra vinegar. Yes, Millie always wanted things just so and wasn't shy about identifying and then taking action to do whatever things, big or small, needed to be done. In her life, she was surrounded by things that she created and people she nurtured. She lived life fully and went out tasting caviar, surrounded by her loved ones. My hat is off to her, and I will never forget her, and I'm glad that her genes live in my children.
We'll hear from Laura now, married to son Daniel.
Well, I was a bit of a challenge for Millie when I first showed up because I wasn't Jewish. And she said to me, "You know, we love you, but we were thinking our grandchildren would be Jewish." And I said, "They will be." And she said, "Oh, I was hoping you would say that." She gave me a big hug, and I never felt anything from her except huge affection for the rest of our relationship. I grew up in a household where my mother worked outside the home, ran her own business, and our house was a little chaotic. And what I learned from Millie was that you could have a different kind of a home. So the first time I ever looked in her freezer, there were all of these containers labeled with a date and what was in them. meals, you know, weeks worth of meals. She had an extra freezer in the garage, and I was so inspired. And my freezer looks like that even today. Her organization of her thread in all the different colors, I thought, oh, this, it was such a reassuring and calming thing. And my sewing box doesn't always look like that, but I'd never even had a sewing box until she gave me my first one and gave me a bunch of thread to organize in it. And I learned how to create a home. She taught me how to make latkes. I didn't always cook to her specifications. The last time I served her my matzo balls, which I think are perfect, she said to me, "These are perfect." And then she took the salt and she said to Maddie, "Needs a little salt." but she always made me feel like I was doing a great job as her daughter-in-law, taking care of her son and her grandchildren. When we were struggling and broken, I had, I think, only one baby, so probably lots of free time. But she said to me, "You need someone to come in and clean." I said, "Well, I can't really afford to do that." And she said, "I'm going to pay for someone to come in and clean for you once every 2 weeks." And she did for the first year when I had a newborn baby. This such a thing had never occurred to me, and was such a gift of generosity. I've never forgotten her. She said to me, "You know, you need some time for yourself. You need time to sit down and read a book." Millie was a feminist, you know, despite teaching me how to run a household, and despite the fact that I would call her if I needed to make a pot roast and she would walk me through it. She was actually a feminist, and in another age, she would have been in Congress or in public life in some way, clearly with her administrative skills. She when I did convert to Judaism, which was years later, her gift to me was a Miriam cup. And she felt strongly about the role that women needed to play in all forms of life, including Judaism. She taught Eli how to sew when he was quite young, and how to knit. And she always encouraged, she wanted to hear the latest story that Alice had written, and always encouraged Alice to think big in terms of her writing and what she wanted to do with her life. Another thing that Millie really modeled for me was sensualism. Carrie referred to the caviar. The day before Millie passed away, she was surrounded by grandchildren and children, and she and Alice had had a date for her 90th birthday to share caviar and anchovies and olives. And Alice said before we drove down, "Millie's not going to be here for her 90th birthday, is she?" And so we got some caviar and we brought it to her, and Alice told her how much she loved her and wanted her to have some caviar now. And Millie had pretty much stopped eating by then. She took a little caviar on the spoon and sort of savored it at lunch, and then she sort of just spaced out as the rest of us ate. But a couple of hours later, we were in her room, and she sort of struggled to sit up a little, and I said, "Millie, do you need something?" And she said, "Caviar." Just a little taste of caviar. It's the first last full sentence I heard her speak. So Millie and I shared a great love of the ocean. She used to drive to the ocean, I think, almost every day at one point in her life. The last time she came out to see us on Fire Island, she said to me, "I think this is the last time I'll see the ocean." And she wanted as long a look at it as she could get. So I will always remember her sitting with a look on her face of just pure joy, looking out at her beloved ocean. And I'd like to think that that's where she is right now.
We'll hear from Arthur now, married to Madeline.
Good afternoon. My name's Arthur Lieberson. I'm married to Maddie. Millie always said I was her favorite son-in-law. when Millie was a little girl, she had a she had in her household a drawer where they kept pennies and nickels to pay the milkman and for small domestic expenditures. And she said that she always wanted a magic nickel drawer, that drawer inspired her to think about a magic nickel drawer, where if you had a drawer with money in it, if you spent a nickel, another nickel would magically appear. And when she turned 65 and started collecting Social Security, she referred to that as her magic nickel, and she became completely generous with her Social Security check. Every month, she would give something to her children, to her grandchildren, to her in-laws, to family friends, to worthy causes. She called it the Millie Mazenary Fund. I knew Millie 30 years. I knew her longer than I knew my own mother. I will always think of Millie as my second mother.
Because you cannot talk to me. You can remember I am here though I am gone. Dust to dust, life goes on. Think of me, I will become a rose in December. In your heart and in your sight, I am eternal light. Hold the torch against the night, and you will remember in the flame are many sparks, touching lives beyond the dark. By my deeds I've left my mark, a rose in December. Say the words that must be said, prayer for beloved dead, and as our precious tears are shed, we shall remember death and loss are what we pay. Finding love along the way, a gift forever, sweet bouquet, a rose in December. If you remember, rose that blooms. In December,
we'll hear now from each of Millie's three children. We'll start with Madeline.
About 8 years ago, I choreographed a dance on the unlikely subject of food. I called it Queen Garlic, and I dedicated it to my mother on the occasion of her 80th birthday. The dance started with a dance done to a poem that I wrote about food as celebration, food as pleasure, food as connection, food as a metaphor for many of the good things in life. I had my mother clearly in mind when I wrote it, and I want to read it now. It's called Cinnamon Toast. Well, there's Cinnamon Toast, and then there's Daddy Toast, which is cinnamon toast that goes under the broiler just until the sugar bubbles. Then there's English muffins with their nooks and crannies, hills and valleys, covered with cream cheese and scallions and a little of last night's wilted salad. What about grilled cheese cut corner to corner with some of its sharp cheddar innards oozing out? Or an orange that practically jumps out of its skin with a burst of sharp tang. And pasta with pesto and pesto with pasta and pasta with pesto and pesto with pasta just before 12, night after night after night. Or a cherry tomato in August that is so sweet it can't decide if it's a fruit or a vegetable or a dessert. And rice, oh rice, steamed pure or sautéed with some friends or all dressed up for the evening. And then there's my mother's sweet and sour cabbage soup and cucumber salad and roasted peppers and pencil-thin asparagus. All hail Queen Garlic and her consort, King Onion, and their savory children and grandchildren. Let us celebrate the potato in all its mutable glory. Prince of adaptation, gracious host to salt. And a big bowl of multi-hued lettuce, none of it iceberg, with radish dimes hidden in it, glistening with vinaigrette. Oh, the sticky pleasures of baklava, and the oily delights of dim sum, and the satin pillowcases of pierogies. How will we live long enough to eat it all? Let's get to work.
And next, Philip.
I was her favorite son, but of course I found out later that whoever was nearest was the favorite. Millie was a wonderful combination of brilliance and practicality. She was also a great supporter of the arts, and in particular, she was a supporter of one photographer specifically. She was my collaborator and my muse. On the slideshow that you may have seen in the lobby, you've seen some of the photographs that she and I made together. In the early 70s, she allowed me to dress the entire family in black turtlenecks, and I had everybody sit for a full 5 second long exposure to make this very dramatic rock and roll style family portrait that was very reminiscent of a Beatles album cover. Then in our most memorable collaboration, she and I set up a card table deep in the California woods where she played a forlorn sales lady vainly trying to sell pine cones for 50 cents while surrounded by a forest floor littered with hundreds of pine cones. I'll show these later. In the 90s, while visiting Montclair, we made a portrait together where she transformed a red T-shirt and a piece of black fabric into a Gloria Swanson Hollywood glamour shot. 2.5 weeks ago, while she was confined to a wheelchair, she had a need for Swedish meatballs. And we went to IKEA. And she thoroughly enjoyed letting me wheel her around in her wheelchair and insert her amongst all the gazillion of tables and desks and shelves that we found in the store. And she posed with her beret stylishly tilted to one side in a long line of empty IKEA chairs, giving the camera a very haughty, "What are you staring at?" look. And this is my favorite picture. We met in the city after Herb died to visit a museum, and afterwards we found a cafe and I made this portrait. She is, as always, simply and elegantly dressed. She's leaning slightly forward, engaging the camera and the viewer directly, frankly, warmly, and with an intelligent twinkle in her eyes. And in one final collaboration for everybody, ready, smile. Thank you. A little bit of biography. Millie Cantor was born Mildred Block on April 13th, 1920. She was the daughter of Tessie and Isidore Block, the middle child between her older sister Edie and her younger brother Jack. The family story is a familiar one, but no less cherished for being so. Both parents were, of course, Jewish immigrants. Tessie from Slutsk, near Minsk. I always like saying that. Isidore from Lithuania. And there were many relatives, and the importance of family ties that were established early in her life. Her childhood was not easy. Her father committed suicide when she was only 5 years old, a death that must have hung over her whole life. It left her mother, the indomitable Tessie, whose namesake and great-grandchild is here today, to raise the family in circumstances that can only be described as dire. They were poor, of course, but no poorer than anyone else they knew. And there was a brief interlude of financial progress towards the middle class, but it soon collapsed. And whether from the experience of everyday life or the ideological atmosphere of the time, Millie and her siblings, like so many others, became firm believers in social and economic justice and committed FDR Democrats. And these early values stuck with her whole life. It was in these years, the 1920s and early 1930s, that she discovered her first true love, books. It was a lifetime love affair. She told me that once she started reading a book, she felt an obligation to read it all the way through. "If the author took the trouble," she told me, "the least I can do is finish it." Now that is a good reader. No doubt, as a result of all this reading, Millie was an excellent student. She attended John Dewey Junior High School and then New Utrecht High School in Brooklyn, finishing it 16, moving on, like so many others, to Brooklyn College. I see some classmates here. Living at home, she commuted to the college, majoring first in chemistry and then switching to speech, what we might think of as literature. She wrote her senior paper on Virginia Woolf, and long have Maddie and I wished we could find it. In 1941, she graduated, a serious, capable, intelligent, progressive young woman in an era when there were not so many avenues open for such. No doubt she wanted a room of her own. World events intervened, and with the U.S. entry into World War II, Millie joined the defense effort. She got a job first with the British Purchasing Agency and then the U.S. Army's Signal Corps labs. She told me they wanted girls with some college math, and so she found her way to Fort Monmouth, New Jersey, to a house full of young Jewish women, all of them working in defense plants, all of them away from home for the very first time. These were heady and exciting years for Millie, who was 22 years old. The girls would host teas for the local servicemen on Sundays and dances. One of them had a Victrola, and they even pooled their money to hire a cook. She soon met Herb Cantor, 7 years her senior, at a folk dancing class near the base. She once told me that she knew right away that she had met an unusually nice fella, which he was. Herb soon shipped out to the Asian theater, but they had time enough to fall in love. And just a few months ago, Millie even allowed that they had spent one forbidden weekend together in New York City, not visiting a single relative. I was glad to learn this. The years passed quickly. They were actually good. The war years passed quickly, and they were actually good years for Millie, as her granddaughter Tess discovered when interviewing her for a school project. "What about the privations and rationing of war, Grandma?" Tess, honey, it was a ball. And so it was. Herb returned from China in late December 1945, and Millie and he married a few weeks later. And with it, the long second act of her life begins. They moved to Long Beach, where she worked as a librarian, and in 1948, they moved to Levittown. She was an original Levittowner and always proud to be a member of that brigade. Maddie commented the other day to Phil and me about the amazing intelligence and dedication and energy of the women who made communities out of these brand new, barely finished neighborhoods that had been potato fields a few months earlier. Millie was among them, raising a family and building a community. There was the babysitting co-op and the embroidery group, and the neighborhood ballroom dancing classes, the Better Education League, typing classes for the neighborhood kids. We literally carried picnic benches to the sidewalk, put our typewriters on them, and sat in folding chairs while the neighborhood typing teacher told us what to do. I know that many historians and sociologists have described the decline in community spirit and volunteerism in these last decades in America, and no doubt they are right. There's actually a famous book on this topic called Bowling Alone. As my sister pointed out, Millie never bowled alone. Of course, she never actually bowled, but you take the point. This devotion to community and the public good was unusually clear in one aspect, the public library. There was no library when Millie arrived in Levittown, and among her life's great accomplishments was the establishment of the Levittown Public Library. In the 1950s, she was president of Friends of the Library, and she ended up serving nearly 30 years on the board, including a few terms as president. This was an elective public office, and Millie was not afraid to take on the opposition. There is a clip from the Levittown Tribune from April 1955, a picture of my mother reading to my older brother, Phil. And here's the caption. Public-spirited mothers aren't exactly a rare thing around here, but Mildred Cantor, wife of Herb Cantor of 78 Sprucewood Drive and president of the Friends of the Levittown Public Library, recently scheduled civic and personal duties almost too close for comfort. Millie got together with other friends, capital F, on Tuesday the 12th to go over the copy for a letter opposing the quote-unquote abolish the library proposition to be voted on, to be written over her signature as president. Not until the letter was in the best possible shape did she relax enough to realize that maybe the letter was, but she wasn't. On Wednesday, the caption continues, on Wednesday the 13th, this is the next day, with the letter copy in the works, Millie hied herself to the hospital and gave birth to Daniel Edward Cantor, 6-pound, 15-ounce baby brother of Madeline and Philip. You'll note that the date of my birthday, April 13th, is of course the same as Millie's. That was Millie having a baby and fighting the good fight with pen and paper. Of course, it wasn't all selflessness. She truly enjoyed being in charge of things and wielding power. One of the pleasures we took as children came from the one perk that accrued to library board trustees, namely the ability to return books late and not pay a fine. We would walk up to the women at the checkout desk and say, "We're Millie Cantor's children." And they would smile and wink. Of course, Millie being Millie, we were almost never late in returning our books, but it was nice to have a backup plan. Truth be told, her love of the library was partly from her love of books and words and language, and partly from thriftiness. She was of the generation that saved more than they spent. This led her to a lifelong dislike of bookstores. She considered them a private answer to a public need. It's an aside, but I've often thought the perfect logo for the Working Families Party would be a public library building, as what else so instantly captures what we're about. Plus, it would remind me of my mother. I don't mean to leave the impression, though, that she lived only in this world of books. She was as practical, as Phil pointed out, as practical as she was intelligent, an accomplished craftswoman, serving as a judge for crafts at the Nassau County Fair, an expert knitter, embroiderer, weaver, and all-around fix-it-yourselfer. She gave lectures on knitting, and turnout was good. She combined her love of good craftsmanship with her social agenda when she got involved in Master Crafters, a nonprofit consignment shop for older artisans. Master Crafters provided a market for their work via the store that Millie and others managed. and it gave her great pleasure to know that not only were these craftspeople keeping busy, they were also making a little money, which many sorely needed. Throughout these decades, Millie's lively mind and active hands were matched with a big heart. She loved her family fiercely, but not exclusively. I am certain that the Appa kids, or the Hirsch kids, or the Lebwohl kids, or any of the many visitors and friends we brought to the house over the years would agree that she was a warm, interesting, and interested in them woman. Julie talked about the wall in the house against which we measured all of the visitors, writing their names, hometowns, and dates in ink on the wall. It was a giant welcome sign, and repeat visitors always checked for the earlier signatures, even after they stopped growing. I know a little less about my mother's life after I left home. I suppose that's common, but I do know that she and Herb kept very busy. Trips to California to visit Edie and Jack, meetings of the Cantor Family Society, which Millie served loyally as secretary. We kids saw her with reasonable frequency, but now it doesn't feel like enough. Mom was a great cook, and family gatherings throughout the 70s and 80s and 90s were always lively and delicious affairs, especially when we started showing up with spouses. I know that Millie was ecstatic when her semi-accomplished children actually started to get married and began procreating in the late 1980s. You might say that Act 3 began with the arrival of the grandchildren, led by Max and followed by Nate and Tess and Eli and Ethan and Alice. Each child filled her with enormous joy, and she bragged about them whenever appropriate, which she thought was basically always. She loved her children's spouses, as I think we've seen today, and bragged about Carrie and Arthur and Laura nearly as frequently as the grandchildren. Manny's husband, Arthur, deserves special mention. Millie deeply adored him, and with good reason. And I want to publicly thank him. Phil and I want to publicly thank him for his devotion to Millie over these 30 years, especially the last few in Philadelphia. It was indeed like she had a third son. After Herb died, Millie's life narrowed. She had wonderful friends in Levittown and Wantagh, some of whom happily are with us today. But life definitely got lonelier. She continued her close to annual trips to visit her beloved brother Jack and her nephews and nieces in California. And she continued to be active in the family society and to read and knit as much as her eyesight would permit. In 2005, she sold the Levitt House. Am I right, Maddie? Yeah. I joked that she'd finally had enough of the interviews with the PhD candidates and the journalists and the sociologists and the filmmakers who somehow ended up at her kitchen table wanting to learn about the early history of Levittown. There must have been at least 24 such interviews over the years. The matching chairs where she and Herb read decades of New York Times' and New Yorkers were given away, and Millie spent her final 2.5 years at Cathedral Village, close to Maddie and her family. She did okay there, but she missed her old home and her old friends, and of course, her husband. Plus the food, she said, was a little bland. Millie, as you've heard today, had a very sensuous relationship with food and knew how to savor a good meal. And she was, as Carrie pointed out, ever willing to send something back into the kitchen at a restaurant, which filled her children with dread. She got sick only a month ago. It was just a week after Alice became a bat mitzvah. In fact, it was on Millie's birthday, our birthday, that she started feeling poorly. And here we are. It has been a powerful few weeks. She knew what was happening. At the end of the long family meeting with the doctor who gave all of us the grim diagnosis, the doctor finished up the meeting by saying, "Mildred, I'm very pleased to have met you." Millie didn't hesitate. "Well, I can't really say the same for you." The five of us left and went out to have Chinese food. She kept her wits about her to the very end, and even as the pain medication made her terribly groggy, Maddie and I were talking to her a few days before her death, and I said something about how Philip, Maddie, and me, and her eyes popped open. She smiled and said, "Philip, Maddie, and I." All three of us had a good laugh. She liked to laugh, and in this regard, she married well.
At Alice's bat mitzvah, Alice and Doug sang a song that the three Kotler brothers, Millie's nephews, wrote. It's called Standing on the Shoulders, and it had been rattling around in my mind since the event. And on my very last visit with Millie, just a few hours before she died, I said to her, "Mom, I just want to thank you and Dad for letting us stand on your shoulders for all that you did for us." And I know that I speak for my brother Phil and my sister Maddie when I say that we are still standing on your shoulders and that we are so very proud to be Millie Cantor's children.
In a moment, we're going to stand up. We're going to rise in Millie's memory. I'm going to chant the El Mole Rachamim. It says, "Compassionate God, grant perfect rest under the shelter of your wings to our beloved Mildred Cantor," and I will sing her name in Hebrew. "May her soul be bound up in the bond of life eternal, and grant that the memories we have of Millie's life inspire us always to noble and consecrated living." Please rise. El male rachamim shochen v'amaromim hametze menucha nechona tachat kanafe ha-shechina im kedoshim utorim kizohar araki amasirim et nishmat malka ester bat taibol v'yisrael shalacha leolamim bal rachamim yastireha beseter kinafav leolamim veitzror bitzror hachayim et nishmata Adonai unachalata vetanuach al mishkava b'shalom v'nomar. Amen. Please be seated.